Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel of speakers. First of all, Mary Radu. Mary is a certified life coach and philanthropy consultant. She helps midlife individuals and couples make meaningful lives by focusing their time, money, and energy to improve their lives and the world around them. Mary inspires and supports her clients to uncover their values and motivations that lead to fulfilling choices and greater impact in the world through their career, philanthropy, and lifestyle. Mary, would you raise your hand? Okay. Mary will lead off tonight. Next is Ben Yohannan. Ben? Ben is president of Hatch Retirement Services. He began his career in financial services in 1991, specializing in retirement plans such as 401k, 403b, IRAs, to name a few, and now he's the principal of the firm his father started in 1977. As a second-generation investment advisor, Ben helps an increasing number of the firm's clients hatch their nest eggs. Very good, Ben. All right. And Denise Michaud. Denise has been in the insurance industry for 29 years and for the last 19 years has specialized in long-term care planning. Her advisory work with the Department of Health Care Services and Senate Subcommittee on Aging brings a highly respected level of planning expertise to her clients. She has trained hundreds of agents and developed the first continuing education course on long-term care suitability in the country to simplify the perplexity of appropriate planning for financial professionals. I want to welcome our distinguished panel, and Mary, would you lead off with the program? Thank you.
Thank you, John. It's great to have all of you here tonight, and we're really looking forward to this series, this two-part series starting tonight, focused on planning for how to create the future that you most want. We'll be focusing on three aspects of longevity planning that will help you take stock of your resources, primarily your financial and your material resources. There are three essential ways that you can use your resources. You can either enjoy them, you can grow them, or you can give them away. In tonight's series, we are going to be talking about enjoying your resources. We'll be talking about how to spend your money to support your lifestyle that entails developing an income plan. We'll also be talking about growing your resources, saving for your future, including contingencies like healthcare needs that you may have in the future. In the second part on Monday, October 3rd, we'll be focusing on how to set aside your resources, how to give them away, how you want to define the way you leave your tangible resources, your money, your home, your other assets, as well as some of the intangible ways that you want to be remembered when you're no longer here. So I want to clarify one area that we aren't going to be addressing tonight, and that is that we're not going to be addressing questions about the current economic conditions and where the market is going on the national and the international setting. That's a huge other topic that we really don't have time to address. So if you'll please withhold any questions during the question and answer part of the session from that topic. I want to encourage you to write some notes as we're going along. If you have any questions, we have the question and answers session at the end, and I want to make sure that we address the issues that come up as we go along. We're here to encourage you to do your own longevity planning so that you can have the best life possible. Planning reduces risk. Planning helps clarify your choices, and it also helps expand the options that are possible for you when you do the planning when you're not in a crisis mode. I'm going to give you a little context about why it's important to do longevity planning and what it might mean for you in your life. We're all part of an aging nation and a world. We see a lot of gray hair here tonight, and a lot that's probably underneath the coloring. From the 2010 census, we learned that the average lifespan for a man today is about 76 years, and for a woman, it's 81. So many of you here in the room are going to live well into your 90s, 80s and 90s. So let's see what that means for you. I'm going to ask each of you to put a look into your crystal ball and to imagine, based on your heredity, your personal history, as well as your current health and lifestyle, how long you think you may be here on this planet. How long are you going to live? So if you will imagine that year, that age, and then I want you to take your current age and I want you to subtract that number. So if you think you might live until you're 90, and this is crystal ball, and you're 60 today, that means that you have about 30 years to live. Now I want you to add 5 years to that for contingencies, because you just might live longer. So from that perspective, everybody here in the room most likely is going to have up to another 5 years to live. How many people calculated that they're going to have 10 years to live? If you put your hands up, okay, we've got some hands. How many people might think that they'll live from 11 to 15 years? Okay. And how about 16 to 20 years? Okay. And how many people think they're going to live more than 20 years? Okay. Okay. So we've got a lot of hands here of people who believe they're going to stick around for quite a while. So you see that there's a good amount of time that's going to be impacted by the way you live your life, as well as the amount of time and energy you put into planning for your future. I want to bring that home to you on a very personal level of how important this is. Living a long time can have a lot of benefits, and it can also have not so many blessings. So there's two sides of the coin. So what's possible for you in terms of the possibilities and the choices in having longevity? What are the possibilities and the choices? Okay. Well, first of all, our generation is better educated, and we're going to continue to live and grow into our older years. Brain research shows that we not only, with education, we live better, but with brain research, we're learning that our brains continue to grow, and in addition to that, it continues to grow into older age, and we have a lot more of ability to make linkages between the left and the right brain, which means that we're able to problem solve a lot better than we have been in prior situations where we were maybe mostly logical thinkers or creative thinkers. We can bring those two together. We have better health and health technology that makes it possible for us to stay active and engaged into our 70s and 80s and beyond. There's lots of information on the web available to us that we can use to improve our health. There are a lot of new drugs that help us reduce the symptoms of our ailments, and also cures for the diseases that during past generations may have meant that we wouldn't have been around this long. We're living longer and better lives, and it means that we have more choices for how we spend our time. In the second half of life, in this period that used to be called retirement, which meant you were moving away from. And now we're in an active aging period and a second half of life that some people call midlife and some people call the bonus years. We have technology that helps us keep connected with others and to learn. Even with reduced mobility and inability to travel, we have ways of staying connected. I have friends in their 70s and 80s who are using the web for internet, for emails, or you're using Skype for being able to stay in touch with grandchildren and children around the world and friends. And there are lots of ways to get involved in and stay active in life and connected using chat groups on the web, using things like Meetup that allows you to find out what's going on in your local community, where you can go see people face-to-face and do things in areas of interest that you might have. There's even online dating service. I had a client who was 78 who had lost his wife, and he wasn't ready to be alone. Well, I challenged him to go out. He found a new bride. And 6 years later, they're still happy together. So lots of possibilities. We have opportunities for staying engaged through work in later life, as well as volunteer opportunities. There are so many organizations out in our communities that need our help, especially with reduced resources through the typical sources that have been available in the past. And they need our skills and they need our interests. Positive psychology research also shows that staying engaged through volunteerism contributes to happiness and also to emotional well-being. Volunteerism also expands our networks, and it gives us new places for us to get information for the problem solving that we have, whether it's the best place to go play bingo or the best specialist that we need if we're looking for a medical specialist, or where to find the best hot dog in town. There are also new community models that are evolving. John mentioned one a few minutes ago. They either replace or can supplement our families of origin and offer new models for living. There's co-housing opportunities where people have their own living space, but they're sharing communal cooking space and communal places for washing their clothes and tools, lending libraries, those kinds of things. There's also aging in place and aging in community models like the San Francisco Village that allow us to supplement our own resources through the use of volunteers in our community, and the organization helps us get linked up with community resources, volunteers, and as a last resort, vetted service providers that can help us stay in our homes as we're unable to do things that we used to do for ourselves. Okay. There's also new professional organizations and services that are evolving to meet the current needs. The three of us are up here. I'm going to turn 60 this year, and I got involved in the field, and many of the people in this field got involved because they were passionate about finding solutions for themselves and for the other people in their lives, and they found ways to create new services to serve the public. So we come from a place of passion and understanding the issues of growing older. There are services like grief counseling, there's geriatric care managers, there's life planners like me who help people find new careers in later life or find where it is that they want to put their passions to work for the benefit of their communities. And dealing with kinds of issues that may happen when there's two spouses that are now at home in retirement. Now what do we do? And there are financial planners and specialties like long-term care specialists. So many people find when they reach their 40s, 50s, 60s, and above that this is really an exciting and a fruitful time of their life where all the experience and the skills and the wisdom, yes, the wisdom that we've built up out of all the experiences that we've had all come together in a very unique way. So let's look at the other side of the coin. What are the challenges for life after 50? Aging in America is not only a personal issue, it is a societal issue. The 50-plus population, the generation, is overtaking our population in terms of numbers. 45 million baby boomers turned 65 this year, and there are 10,000 more baby boomers that are turning 65 every day. Did you know that half of the people who have ever lived to be 65 are now alive? And that number is going up. So that this graying of the nation is having a major impact, not only on our financial stability, but on our economics, and it's having a huge impact on our institutions as well. There's also a huge personal financial challenge. According to the Wall Street Journal in March, 54% of people over 45 had less than $25,000 saved for their future. That impacts not only the individual, but their family and the communities that they're in. It's huge. At the same time, although we lack jobs, we have a lack of jobs to go around right now, that is going to change. The demographics in our society are changing. By 2019, there are going to be less younger people available. And a study of AARP indicates that by 2019, people over 55 are going to represent 25% of the workforce. And they'll be working because they need to, or they'll be working because the nation and their communities need them. The people that will take those positions will be those that have updated their skills to be able to address the needs of the emerging economies and industries that are coming up, like the green industry, healthcare industry, or they will be people who are taking low-income jobs because they are in unskilled jobs that will be available. Okay. We're also living longer, and living longer means that we're going to be living with more chronic disease. Chronic disease means that we're going to be needing caregiving. We're going to need it ourselves. Our family members are going to need it. Our neighbors are going to need it. And another Wall Street Journal article indicated that the percent of adult children 50 years and older caring for their adult parents has tripled since 1994. And caregiving has a serious impact. It puts a serious strain on the adult children's and the caregivers' income, their ability to earn a living because they need to be available to deal with the caregiving. And it also contributes to their own health and mental health problems. So, and it impacts their relationships. And the biggest cost is for the women. So what we know from our research and our experience with clients like you and you in this population range is that with introspection about what's most important about your life and with planning, it is possible to overcome the fears and the uncertainty and the anxieties that come up around the unknowns in life and replace it with a sense of adventure and excitement for what's coming. So change is one thing we can all count on in our lives. Do you agree? Well, even with planning, which is important, we still can't be sure where our journey is going to take us during these future years. We may have a change in our health that we didn't expect. We may have change in our relationship or the roles that we play in our lives. And yes, we're also learning that with these rocky economic times, the conditions of our finances can change in ways that we never expected. However, we can experience what I want to call positive aging, and look for that name in the news and on the web. We can experience positive aging if we take an active role and stay in the driver's seat for our own lives. The choices that we make in facing the personal opportunities and the challenges that we face will have a direct impact on ourselves, our families, and the communities that we live in. This is the way that we each get to make a difference in life. So at this point, I want to turn it over to Ben and to Denise, who are going to give you some great ideas on how to plan to manage your future. Ben?
Thanks very much, Mary. Well, the points that she makes in the introduction to tonight's presentation, I agree wholeheartedly with. So much so that my practice has really gravitated towards the term longevity planning. We think it's a much better way of looking at one's life in retirement and how to plan for the transitions that happen in retirement. And to that degree, we think when looking at developing income streams or an income plan, that one should look at their time in retirement as in distinct phases. Those phases being the active phase, and because it's an easy way for tonight's discussion, we'll call that between age 64 and 75, and then the stable phase between 75 and 85, and then the third phase being the secure phase. So hopefully one of the takeaways from tonight is that it might give you a new way of looking at how to plan. And in that way, I mean like this. When you're in your active phase, you have better health, and you're probably going to have more spending on discretionary things, travel, hobbies, things of that nature. But as you move along the human time frame, you'll probably be scaling back your leisure activities as you get more into the stable phase, do less traveling, but healthcare issues might start to surface. So if you think of that as dials on how much spending you're going to do, you're going to have more spending on the leisure side and the active phase, and then you're going to, as you go through the phases of retirement, have more spending on healthcare. So it's probably a more accurate way to forecast what those spending needs could be in the future. And it's a little bit, I think, more robust way of building a plan rather than the traditional straight line approach, which is, okay, you need 80% of what you were living on, you're going to slap on a 3% inflation rate, and then you're going to live to 86. Okay, here's your plan. But, you know, what's perfect about that plan is we know when you're going to pass away. And I'm going to bet on your longevity, and that's why you need to build a plan that's going to think about the longer term and then how you interact during those different phases. So I'm going to segue from that and talk about some of the major risks that are part of building a retirement plan and take a lens of longevity. So take a look at those risks from a perspective of longevity. So the first risk I would be remiss in not mentioning is investment risk, but Mary said we can't talk about that tonight. So I'm not going to. It's a whole other subject. The next major risk would be inflation. And I think we all have a pretty good grasp of what inflation is. We fill up our cars every single day. So the longer you live, the greater impact inflation will have at eating away your future purchasing power. The next major risk would be what we term distribution rate. So in layman's terms, that's how much you're going to spend from your nest egg. So if you have a nest egg of $1 million and you're withdrawing $40,000 a year to support your lifestyle, that's a 4% distribution rate. And a lot of the talking heads say that a 4% distribution rate is the magic number, indexed for inflation. So if you have a portfolio of 50% stocks, 50% bonds, a 4% distribution rate indexed for inflation has roughly a 95% chance of lasting 30 years. If you crank that up to 5%, then that probability gets reduced to roughly 70%. So what distribution rate you incorporate into your plan is going to have a major issue. It's going to be tied very closely to your longevity. So the lower your distribution rate, the better hedge you have for betting on your longevity. The next risk that I'm going to talk about is also kind of a fancy term, which is sequence of returns. What that really means is, what is your timing with the markets when you start making those distributions or beginning that income stream? If you are withdrawing money in a bear market or you have terrible timing when you start withdrawing the money, that's going to have a major impact on the success or that probability of an income plan lasting 30 or more years. It's very, very hard to recoup losses in the beginning of the distribution phase. So your timing is something, you know, things that you can't control here are what the markets do, the timing of your retirement, inflation, you can't really control inflation, rising health care costs, you can't really control those very well either. So it's important to have these contingencies built into a plan for those things that you can't control. And one of the ways that we think is a very good way of addressing the problem of withdrawing money in a bear market is to utilize a income plan that we call it's basically a basket approach, where you take your nest egg, and maybe the best way I can explain this time segmented approach is if I do a really low tech demonstration, and laughing is okay. All right, so let's assume this purple cup represents your nest egg. What you would do is divide your investments for a time frame of how you're going to spend your money. So here we go. A good chunk is going to go into this large cup, which is invested very conservatively. This is where you would be pulling out your money. So with the ups and downs of the stock market won't impact this cup in a detrimental way. Then in the middle cup here, you invest moderately. And then in the final cup, you invest more aggressively for growth. So if we think about this in the context of the three phases of retirement, which we're using for simplicity's sake and discussion's sake, 10-year time frames. So the first 10 years, you withdraw all your money out of the conservative investment vehicles. For the next 10 years, you're moderately invested. Your moderately invested funds grow to a point where then you shift it over to a more conservative investment and start the process again. So now you've got your last bucket that's riding for 20 years. This can handle the ups and downs of the stock market because it has a much longer time horizon. It grows for 20 years, shifts over, start the process over again. So that's a time segmented approach, and I think it does a very good job of addressing the volatility in the markets as well as investor behavior, because sometimes we can be our worst enemies and getting too emotional about pulling money out of this account and moving it here. So if you know that your income is going to be in place for the next 10 years, what the stock market or bond markets do on a day-to-day basis will be less important. So it's one concept that I wanted to leave with you today. And last but not least of the five risks is healthcare costs. And I'm going to pass the baton on that risk to Denise. But in closing, I want to say of those five risks, there's really three where longevity plays a pivotal role in managing that risk, and that would be inflation, your distribution rate, and rising healthcare costs, which I'm going to let Denise steal my thunder on that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to talk about long-term care, not medical costs. But in the old days, people, most everyone planned for long-term care. Oh, can't hear me. Tell me if this is better. No? Closer. Is this better? Okay. Yes? So in the old days, most people planned for long-term care. And the plan was very simple. The wife was going to take care of the husband. And what happened is the husband passed away. The wife's health had deteriorated because of so much stress and caregiving. She was alone, and there was no plan for her. So that didn't work then, and it doesn't work now. So that is one of the main reasons people plan in advance for long-term care, is because they don't want to burden the spouse or the adult kids. Another reason, of course, is they want to make sure they protect their assets so that they can pass the assets on to family or charity, and maybe more importantly, to make sure that they delay or avoid going on Medi-Cal, state aid. They also want to make sure there's money left for the surviving spouse, so the surviving spouse can continue to have a good lifestyle. So when you think about long-term care, what do you think about? What comes to your mind? Yes, exactly. And that is such an old idea. But whenever you read articles in the paper or in the magazines, they still focus on nursing home care. So long-term care is so much broader than that now. And 80 to 90% of people who receive care are at home. So almost everything can be done at home now. And home means where you live that's not a facility. So long-term care insurance pays for home care, also pays for assisted living facility and nursing home care. The purpose of insurance, a long-term care insurance, is to shift the risk and shift the cost so that not the whole burden of paying for your care is not on you. And the risk is actually pretty high. When you turn 65, we have a 70% chance of needing care. We have 80 million baby boomers getting older, and I have a feeling that 70% is going to get higher. We have an average length of stay at home. People need care for, on average, 5 to 6 years, 2 to 3 years in a facility. That's probably going to get longer, too. And another exciting statistic is once we hit 80, we have a 50% chance of having a cognitive problem, which is memory loss, disorientation, that kind of thing. And once we have that kind of memory issues, we could need care for as much as 7 years. Well, it could be 20 years, but the average is 7 years. So one of the questions that I get is, the insurance companies, do they really pay out the money? And last year, the big group of insurance companies that sell the most policies, they paid out $11 million every single day. Every single day. In total, they've paid out $60 billion for long-term care services. But people are still paying for their care out of their pocket, and they have paid, people out of their pocket have paid $90 billion. So it's a tremendous amount that is still being paid out of people's pocket, depleting assets, and sometimes really upsetting the lifestyle of the surviving spouse. So the insurance has a range of coverages, and the main thing is to come up with strategies. And there's different strategies. There's a range of strategies. And I thought I'd give you three examples, real-life examples. And the first person I'm going to talk about, I'm going to call her Penelope Penniless. Because unfortunately, she doesn't have very much money. So Penelope is 65, and these are real people. She's 65. She only has a couple thousand dollars in the bank. She's divorced. She has no kids. She gets Social Security and pension, and she works part-time. So besides her part-time work, she does have some discretionary money that she tries to put away. She rents a room in a friend's home. And she doesn't have any family, so her friends are her family. And her friends said, if you ever needed care, we will take care of you. Don't worry about it. You can always stay here. But she's very proud. She wants to be self-sufficient, and she doesn't want to be a burden on her friends. So in looking at her situation, she's really an ideal candidate for Medi-Cal. If she needed care, she would go on state aid, go into a nursing home, receive care for the rest of her life. However, there are no beds available in her area for Medi-Cal. So she would, and she doesn't need care now, but do you think in 20 years there's going to be beds available? No. So she would be sent to another county. So she'd be away from her friends. So her objective is to find a way to stay in her community. So this is what we did. She bought a policy that would pay for 1 year of care in a nursing home. So it doesn't pay for home care. It starts right away if she needs care. It increases with inflation. So it's always going to stay in step with inflation. So if she needs care, she's going to go into a nursing home that accepts Medi-Cal. She's going to go in as a private paying patient. And then when the year is up, the policy's over, she can apply for Medi-Cal. And even if there's not a bed available in that nursing home, they can't kick her out. So she gets to stay in her community. Now, another part of that policy is that it's called a California Partnership Plan. A California Partnership Plan says that if you have this kind of policy and you have to go on Medi-Cal, then you can keep assets equal to the amount of benefits that you received. So let's say she went into a nursing home and she and the insurance paid $100,000 for her care for that first year. Then she could keep $100,000 of assets, right? But she's not going to have $100,000 of assets, right? But during that year, she won't have to spend her Social Security or pension. So she can save that up. Let's say it's $30,000 or $40,000 at the end of the year. She is able to keep that $30,000 or $40,000, and that way she could go on Medi-Cal, and it would enhance her life. Because otherwise, when you're on Medi-Cal, you can only keep $35 a month of income and $2,000 in savings. So that was a good strategy for her. And the premium costs her about 25% of her discretionary money, not including her part-time job, because we can't assume she's going to have that. So that's a good solution for her. She's very happy to have that plan. The next case is, I'll call Sam and Sally Saver. They save $5,000 a month for their retirement. They're 43 and 50. So you think maybe that's young to prepare for long-term care, but they've had some personal experience with it. So they're 43 and 50. They have no kids. They're both working, so they're both saving together $5,000 a month for their retirement. They've already got $300,000 that they've saved. So they're on their way to have a really good retirement. But there is a big gaping hole in their plan. Because what if one of them has a chronic problem, needs care, then they wouldn't be able to contribute towards their retirement savings. And they'd have to pay for the care. They'd have to use up some of their assets. So they know they need to plan for long-term care. But the other thing is, Sally's mother hadn't made really good choices in her life. And she's in her 70s and doesn't have very much money, and they are actually financially supporting her mother. If her mother needs care, she will end up going on Medi-Cal. They don't want to be in that position ever. So what we did, because they're still saving for retirement, if they needed care earlier versus later, they wouldn't be able to pay for any of their care. So they insured themselves for $250 a day of coverage, $7,500 a month. So if they needed care, they'd have access to $7,500 a month for their care. Increases by 5% compound inflation. And they bought a policy where they could share each other's policy. So basically, together, they have $1.1 million of coverage that will increase with inflation, and they feel really good about that plan. The other point of the plan is if they needed care and got better, which is happening more and more, the insurance company will restore the benefits back to the whole amount. So the third, and we don't have much time, but the third case I'm going to call Lori Legacy. She wants to leave a legacy. Lori is 72, in pretty good health. She is never going to need long-term care. That's what she says. She has some money. She has $100,000 over here, besides other money, but she has $100,000 over there in a CD. That money is going to, she's leaving that money to her grandkids. So she doesn't want to buy long-term care insurance because she's never going to need long-term care insurance, never going to need long-term care, but just in case, she's going to use that $100,000. So instead, what we do, we put that $100,000 in a plan that if she passed away and doesn't need long-term care, $125,000 goes to the grandkids. If she needs long-term care, she's got $250,000 that she can use for her long-term care instead of $100,000, and she didn't have to pay a penny for it. So she's really happy. All these three examples just give you an idea that there are different strategies. There's a range of strategies. When you need long-term care, it doesn't just happen to you. It does affect all the people around you. So when you plan positively, then the people around you are going to benefit as well. So thank you.
Before we get into the question and answer session, I want to have us leave you with a few nuggets from this evening. I want to leave you with one nugget from my piece of the presentation. And the nugget that I would like to leave you in the audience with is that you, on a regular basis, that means time every week or at least every month, you set aside some hours on your schedule. You actually write it down when you're going to do it, and you make time to take the next step in your life planning, whatever that is, whether it's that you need to focus on your financial plan, whether it's you need to focus on your long-term care insurance needs, whether it's looking at how you want to get involved in giving back in your community through volunteerism and doing that research. Whatever it is, that you take time and that you create a schedule for yourself so that it will happen. So I'm going to ask Ben, I'm going to ask you for three nuggets.
I'll go fast because I know we're short for time. And maybe I'll just condense it into one nugget. My homework assignment for everybody here would be to go back home, take a look at your financial plan if you've made one, and put the lens of longevity on that plan. Look at it from not dollars and cents, but from lifestyle, from what you want to do, to what you think you're going to do, to what may happen, and put the hat or the lens of longevity on it and see how well it stacks up. And then for those that haven't made a plan, make a plan.
And I do have a handout with my three thoughts on here, which you can pick up after. But the first thing is, I would say, think about what worries you most when you know, if you ever need care, what is the thing that worries you most? And the plan that you do should take that worry away. And when you plan for yourself, then people are going to benefit from what you do. And there are positive solutions for almost every situation.
Thank you very much. I want to thank our panel, Mary, Ben, Denise, for your comments tonight. And don't forget, they'll be back on October 3rd. Denise will
be
replaced. be in the audience, and we'll have Elizabeth Cravazzi here. And just think of it, it's an opportunity to have a glass of wine and free legal advice. And it's here at the Grown Ups Forum. I am John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and will be moderating today's audience question period. We'd like to remind our audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to the Longevity Panel Part 1 with our distinguished guests. Now, I know there are questions. Stacy, will you pass the microphone for questions, please?
Mr. Hatch, most of the calculators I've found for Social Security to decide, you know, when to start taking Social Security make the assumption that the wife is younger. In my case, it's not. And I have not been able to find a decent calculator that will allow me to decide when to do that.
How to optimize the Social Security.
To optimize Social Security. And because one of the strategies I considered was to do higher than 4% out of the 401ks and the IRAs to then allow myself to not draw Social Security until I'm 66 or 67 or something like that. But I can't find anything available either for purchase or from the calculators out there. Any ideas?
I can't bring the whole store with me to this meeting tonight. So I do have a lot of resources back at my office. And if you want to see me after and give me an email address, I'll see what I can send you. But to that point, though, I would say, again, this is a longevity panel. You may want to, if you're going to be taking a higher distribution rate than 4%, you may want to hedge it with some additional guarantees should longevity be on your side.
Hi, very, very interesting presentations. Really appreciate it. But I wonder if you could give any just rough guidelines as to how much we should think about budgeting for healthcare costs, given maybe an assumption of only modest changes to Medicare and Medicare Advantage. And then as a corollary to that, for long-term care insurance, any feel for what kind of average daily rate we should plan for, of course, assuming inflation. You mentioned 250 for one of your clients, for example.
Yeah, in this area, depends on the area you live, but generally I'd say 250 is what I see people incurring, and it can be less, it can be more. It doesn't mean that you have to insure for the whole amount. A lot of people insure for, let's say, 80% of the cost and then know that they'd be out of pocket the balance.
Denise, could you say a little bit more about that? We have an audience that's maybe outside the Bay Area, so could you talk about how that rate gets changed or it varies?
Well, actually, if you live outside the Bay Area, sometimes if you live in a more rural area, the cost can be even higher because the services, there are fewer services, right? And so there's less competition, or there's more skilled care, not, you know, less, more custodial care, and so you're paying for skilled care when you don't really have to. So it's a matter of finding out what your resources are in your area, and that's really an important thing to do, is to know if you needed care, which resources would you trust the most, and align yourself with a care manager. Get to know who the care managers are in the area, the nurses and social workers. Those are the people that assess your situations. And also, they're the people that can help coordinate your services, too. They know the volunteer services in the area and the good caregiving services.
And my two cents on that question would be, I've seen a number of studies that looked at healthcare expenses for a couple, 65 each, and this figure that I'm going to give you does not include long-term care expenses, but depending on the study, is anywhere from $250,000 to $400,000. For a 65-year-olds through their life expectancy.
So how would that translate? So adjust that for inflation to estimate how much.
Right. And, you know, again, this is, when you do these kind of studies, you know, these are large populations and we're all individuals. So it's sometimes the trees get lost in the forest. So we'll also repeat this question when I'm done here. I wouldn't want to say something on a recording and be wrong. So in fairness, I don't want to put myself on the spot other than saying that I've seen studies that have said between $250,000 and $400 for a couple 65, you know, which are going to they're probably using, you know, average life expectancies, you know, in that calculation. And again, I can't say this enough, but that does not include a long-term care event. And the question was, can you estimate what healthcare expenses might be in the future? they'll be higher, would be my other
We're fortunate to live in the most expensive part of the country and probably the most desirable. The cost of living in other areas is as much as half. It's double compared to my hometown in Saginaw, Michigan, where the most expensive house in town is $150,000 and nobody's buying it. I've been considering this subject for some time because as a single person with no dependents, it's me who's going to take care of me. So I engaged a financial planner about 15, 20 years ago, and I would recommend that for everybody. And he suggested at that time that I take out a long-term care policy. In fact, I took out two of them. If you go to check rates, you will find the older you get, the more expensive. And at some point, it's not worth it. And it is a concern. So as a single person, I have some other concerns. He also advised me to cash in my life insurance policy. I got a lot of wealthy nieces and nephews who I don't think they're waiting for me to go to the next world, but they're pretty independent themselves. So I would just say do the planning because change is going to happen, and hopefully you plan for it rather than have it hit you over the head.
That's true. That's true.
I don't understand what you're saying, long-term care. Does that mean you're in a bed being taken care of medically, or does that mean you're just going to a society that's all older people in it?
So the question would be, what does long-term care mean?
Yeah.
When someone needs long-term care, what does it mean? So the general definition is that you need help with your daily activities. So it's when you need somebody to help you get up in the morning, get you dressed or bathe, help you eat your meals or get around. So generally, when you need someone to be near there to physically help you do that or just nearby to make sure you're safe while you do those activities. And usually, most of the kinds of care that people need is just personal care, someone to be there to help you with your activities. And then if you have a cognitive problem, which can 50% of the people who need long-term care seem to have a cognitive problem, then you might know how to dress yourself and get around, but you might forget. So you need to have someone around to supervise you and give you cues. It's time to put your sweater on and to make sure that you're safe and other people are safe around you.
So would this insurance policy hire somebody to come to the house?
Yes.
And take care of
right.
that person?
Right. So the insurance policy gives you money to hire people or to do some modifications to your home so you can stay home.
But then the caretaker, like the wife, or the husband would have some sort of a life too.
If yes, they have some time. Right, they'll have some time off.
Yeah.
Right, so they won't have to be the primary caregiver. Right, and you can receive care at home. People receive care at home in assisted living facility and a nursing home. Do you know the difference between assisted living and a nursing home? A lot of people, you know, get confused about those terms.
Yes.
But just generally speaking, a nursing home is when you need more constant medical care. So you're in a room, there's usually medical monitoring equipment, there's a nurse down the hall in the station. Assisted living facility is when you have your own living space and you can usually go to the dining room and get your meals, but you might need some assistance, a range of assistance. Maybe you need someone to come in and help you bathe in the morning, so that kind of thing. So you have more independence in assisted living facility.
Okay. I have two questions. One is, what would you say that a couple would have needed to save by the time they are, let's say, 65 or 70, so that for the remainder of their life they can live a comfortable lifestyle? And second, would you discuss the kinds of asset allocations that as you reach your 70s and 80s that you should be invested in?
Sure. I to answer your first part of the question, I would want to work backwards on that. So let's put it in today's world. Someone retires at 65. They're getting $20,000 in Social Security. And they do their budget analysis, and they have a they have their annual budget. They need an additional their total annual budget is $60,000, let's say. So back to the 4% rule, they need $1 million to be able to rely on 40,000 additional monies a year to couple with Social Security of 20,000. How one would invest that? Well, I think it's going to be, there's a couple of best practices for developing income plans, and I think the three best practices are the one that I described tonight, the time segmented approach. And in a time segmented approach, you're going to have quite a bit of that nest egg conservatively invested in fixed income instruments. But one of the things that we have to realize is that that equities is probably one of the better investments to combat against inflation. So that strategy also is going to have some equity positions for the long term. We're just not going to tap into it in the volatile markets. Another best practice would be what we call a total return approach, where rather than segmenting the investments for time horizons, you're building a portfolio of stocks, bonds, cash, maybe some alternative investments to a specific risk profile. And to answer your question, you know, you'd probably start at 50% in equities and 50% bonds, and then work backwards or forwards from that based on a client's risk profile. And then you begin harvesting dividends, harvesting gains, and you're getting back to that 4% distribution rate. And then the third best practice would be for somebody who's super conservative and really wants guarantees, is taking a portion of the nest egg and actually maybe buying an immediate annuity with it, which is for a guaranteed income stream that you can't outlive. Not everybody likes buying annuities. Annuities often get a bad rap, and they're misunderstood, but there's sometimes a place for them in a plan. However, annuities don't always do the best job of keeping pace with inflation. So I hope that answers your question.
What do you know about people who live in co-housing communities as they get older? Is there kind of built in, like to a multi-generational co-housing, something where if they need help, they can get help? And do you know, in addition to this, I can't find anywhere in American society where they have something like the kibbutz, like they had in Israel, you know, where it's even more communal than co-housing, where everybody has a room and then, you know, does everything together. And do you know anything like that?
Do you know much about that?
I'll try to address your question. Co-housing is very, there are lots of flavors of co-housing, and it really depends on the specific community. Many co-housing is fairly new in this country, and many of the communities are built by the people who live there. And they've built the communities and incorporated people into their community that have the same values that they have. In some communities, they're thinking about, as they age, how they're going to support each other. I live in the Sebastopol area, and I visited one of the co-housing locations there that I'll talk about just briefly. And when you go to that community, you see that there are young children on bicycles riding around. There are middle-aged people that are working at home. There are older people who are, quote, retired, who are not in the work world, who are there. That community is one that I see as one where they're looking out for each other. They have their own living space with a kitchen, a small, maybe one or two bedrooms, a very small living space, and they have a communal kitchen. They have communal washer and dryer. They have activities that are shared within the community. They get to know each other, and they support each other. So it's like a little village. It's like the old neighborhoods used to be. So that's one flavor of it. But if you're interested, what I would suggest is that you go to, you visit those communities that are in your area and ask some questions. Get to see what they're like and see what kinds of answers they give you. I've also heard about some, I don't know of any, but I have heard of that, and John might be able to address this. In fact, he mentioned this at a meeting that we attended this weekend about looking at some of the facilities that exist in this, in our communities of commercial space that don't have a purpose now, where there are too many commercial spaces. There are hotels that are going unused, and now looking at how, what are alternate uses for those facilities when we need housing.
Panel, I'm sorry, but we've run out of time. We have time for only one more question.
Okay, well, I'll hopefully make a germane question. There are retirement facilities even within this city where you sign on, and I don't know what the mechanism is, how much it pays, how much you have to pay, that if something untoward happens and you get Alzheimer's or you get a stroke, there's care built into that particular program. And so the what I have to ask is, number one, if you have a long-term care policy, which I do, how does that dovetail in? And secondly, how does the mechanism work so that so like insurance, pay into this along with your along with the price of the residence?
I can answer that.
Go ahead. Yeah, I know you can.
there are select retirement communities that are life care communities and do provide levels of care. One of the benefits to a person who keeps his long-term care insurance is that that person can stay in an independent apartment for a much longer period of time with help than otherwise would happen, and he would be asked to move to a higher level of care if he didn't have help at home. So one thing it can do is stave off a move between levels of care, and many people think that's quite worth it. Other people pay out of pocket to have help in their apartment to stay independent in the apartment. So it is a valuable thing to have a long-term care insurance policy, and it's certainly not in conflict with going into a multi-level life care community. Thank you, panel. I have to say that my worst fear is that I'll live long enough to have to be taken care of by my wife. Our thanks to our panel today, Mary Radu, Ben Yohanan, Denise Michaud, and we want to thank our audience here as well as our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.